Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Maxwell's House is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Maxwell's House with Ray Maxwell and Dr. Kiki. Episode 69. I'm just along for the ride.
Hey everyone, it's time for Maxwell's House. I'm Dr. Kiki and...
I'm Ray Maxwell.
Yes, this is episode number 69. I'm just along for the ride and I feel like that. You're in the cockpit here, Ray. Tell me what's happening.
Well, the title comes from a story I'm going to tell late in the show. But let me explain that the program managers at the TWiT Cottage have asked me to focus my show on the area of aviation. And the format that I have decided to follow along those lines is we're going to cover the stories out of the aviation news. I'm going to explain some form of aviation technology or aerodynamics or whatever. And then I'm going to do a very time-honored tradition amongst pilots, and that's known as hangar flying or telling stories about flying. So that's where, and the title comes from a line out of one of the stories I'm going to tell today. I'm just along for the ride. And well, it was uttered by a test pilot, at any rate.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm interested in the stories and hearing what's been going on in the world of aviation news. There's a lot of news recently. Some
there
exciting
is.
Stuff, right?
Yes. One of the first things I've got on my agenda today is there was a tragedy down near, not terribly far from the... TWiT Cottage, just south of you folks at the Palo Alto Airport. Three Tesla employees, people in the high-tech industry, were killed in a crash of a Cessna 310 flown by one of the Tesla engineers by the name of Doug Bourne. And they're still gathering data. They don't know exactly what happened. The facts that I was able to gather just before the show were that the conditions at the Palo Alto Airport were marginal IFR. They were, the ceiling was 100 feet and the visibility was close to 1/8 of a mile. Now, that's the bare minimum for taking off.
Wow.
And it's not, it's, I'm not sure, I don't know the full equipment at that airport or the aircraft. But I would think that that'd be below landing minimums for that aircraft in that airport. But at any rate, it was very low visibility, and the plane crashed. And again, I got conflicting reports here, but the majority of the reports I could find explained that the plane crashed off of the end of the runway, close to the airport, and it appears that what may have happened, and this is speculation, but some of the reporters were speculating that an engine had failed. It was a twin-engine airplane, and the engine had failed, and the pilot had lost control and crashed. Now, let me explain something that this brings up that's a little bit controversial, but nonetheless true. I have a multi-engine rating. I have flown twin-engine aircraft, light twin-engine aircraft. And light twin-engine aircraft, there is a great debate about their safety of a twin-engine aircraft versus a single-engine aircraft. And a lot of lay people, when I say that, go, what are you talking about? It's obvious. A plane with two engines is safer than a plane with one engine. That's not the case.
Doesn't have anything to do with the number of engines.
Well, in fact, there's a case that can be made that a small twin-engine airplane, in some ways, if not in the hands of a very experienced pilot, can be more dangerous than a single-engine airplane. Let me explain why. If a conventional twin-engine airplane with the engines mounted on the wings, the thrust from each engine is off the center line of the aircraft. So if you are at full throttle taking off and you've just lifted off and started your climb and you lose one engine, you suddenly lose half of the power of the aircraft, and the power, the full powered engine is still running, is trying to yaw you or turn you fairly violently to one side. And if you have not reached the minimum single engine climb speed for that aircraft, you can lose control of the aircraft. If you start to climb out and lose that engine at a critical time and you have not reached a airspeed where the rudder, when deflected fully, can keep the airplane from turning, you can get into a stall spin accident with a light twin. So there's a critical period during takeoff that if you lose an engine, you can be in real trouble if you haven't reached this minimum controllable airspeed for a light twin. And there is some speculation. We don't have all the facts. I don't know whether an engine failed. They'll be able to tell that from going through the wreckage and know whether this is what's happened. But that's the information we have at this time. So it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy amongst the high-tech community in the Palo Alto area. These people were well known by the high-tech community there in California. And as it crashed and it burned, the people were severely burned and appeared to have died instantly at the crash. So that's sad story. I have a follow-up on the Tu-154 accident in Russia. This was the aircraft that had the Polish president on board. I have been able to dig out a few more facts to add to that. I talked to a friend of mine that has access to all kinds of airline databases, and I was trying to find out and get an actual approach plate for that airport. But it's either a military airport or former military airport in Russia, and so that information apparently is not available. But I have found out that the only nav aid, or the nav aid they were using in flying in there, was what's called an NDB, non-directional beacon. And this is, I want to be careful how I word this. This is one of the more primitive ways of navigating an aircraft to a certain spot. It is simply a radio beacon, and you have a indicator in the cockpit showing you what direction that radio beacon is with reference to the nose of your aircraft. And usually in North America, a NDB approach, if an airport has that, usually the minimums, in other words, the minimum decision height where you would pull up and go around, is typically 500 feet above ground, assuming that you're in flat terrain with no mountains nearby. So it appears that the guy flew, the pilots, the young military pilots, 36 years old, flew below those minimums and hit trees. And, you know, we don't know. Did they think they saw the airport? Did they think they saw the runway? I don't know. Now, I have heard from the voice recordings, and I've seen a Russian transcription of the voice recorder that has been released, but I haven't seen an English translation, and I don't read Russian. So I'm waiting to hear that, but the condensed notes from that said that there was no pressure from the cabin of the airplane. That I don't mean pressurization. I mean there was no one came forward and said, you've got to land this airplane, like the president or one of the higher military persons on board. That's what they're reporting at this time. But that doesn't mean that those young pilots didn't feel pressure to get that plane down in that location. Clarification was I mentioned I had first heard that the aircraft made three approaches. That's not the case. It circled the airport looking at the fog bank and looking for openings three times, and then it flew one approach and crashed on that approach. The other piece of data that I now have is that another aircraft, a military aircraft, a Russian military aircraft, was refused clearance to land there. Now, they can refuse a military aircraft, the air traffic controllers, the ground people can say, you can't land here. But they cannot refuse other civilian aircraft, which this was a foreign military aircraft from Poland.
Right.
And they are allowed to shoot an approach if they want to. And that's what they chose to do. So that's a few more details that I was able to get about the Tu-154 incident.
That's great. Thanks for the update on that. It was quite a terrible crash, and it's good to know what happened and how the situation arose. Probably because, as we talked about last week, there probably was pressure on the pilots to land when maybe they shouldn't have. And fascinating that they refused to allow a military plane to land, but the civilian, they were allowing a civilian plane to land at that time.
Well, the chain of command or the decision-making procedure is different for those two aircraft.
Yeah.
It's the pilot's, in some cases, it's the pilot's responsibility. But evidently, the traffic controllers in Russia can refuse clearance to land due to weather conditions for a Russian military aircraft. So I'm told. I'm still doing more research.
Right.
I could have an update on that next week.
Good. More updates. The other big news this week, there has been the giant volcanic ash cloud that we talked about, that everyone's been talking about. I had a friend who was stranded in Switzerland as a result of the airport closures. People are flying again now, right? Things are open?
As of my last check on the internet, and this is an hour-by-hour story, Europe was 100% open again. But
good.
Remember, there's going to be a backlog that, you know, is an absolute airline dispatch office nightmare. They're really going to have a rough time getting rid of all this backlog and getting everybody to where they want to be. Now, let me just review quickly what I've covered both last week and on a special a couple of days ago. We did a short special on this because this is changing so rapidly, this whole story. The ash from some volcanoes, this is a variable, can contain silica. And if it contains silica, that's a glass component. And when it goes into a jet engine and reaches the hot areas of the engine, it can melt and then coat the interior of the engine with glass. And that can stop up fuel jets. It can stop up various probes that are in the engine and cause the engine to flame out. So it's quite serious. People have written me and said, well, what about a prop aircraft? Well, they have a different mode of failure, but they can also fail to operate.
I like the wording in that, a different mode of failure.
Yeah.
It's not just that they are designed differently. It's a different mode of failure. I think that's going to be a new favorite phrase for me. Thanks.
Right.
Thanks for that.
Okay. But what happens is their air inlets, they have a filter, and that filter can get stopped up if if enough particles enter it. So, so they also, have a problem. Now, the big problem here is lack of data. They don't have a good way to know, detect the difference between a cloud that contains moisture, in other words, an ordinary cloud, and a cloud that contains silica or other rock particles or things that could damage the engine. You also need to know to decide whether you're going to fly aircraft through that area, the density of the ash in the air.
Yeah.
And this last week, there were test flights. The airlines did some low-altitude flying. Lufthansa repositioned 10 aircraft, and I understand they flew them at low altitudes, stayed out of the cloud, and, of course, had no incident. By the way, there was no one on board those aircraft but the crews. No passengers.
This seems like a situation for a UAV as opposed to an actually piloted test flight. I mean, wouldn't you think that, in this age of robotic planes that we can pilot from the safety of, a room somewhere in Nebraska, that we wouldn't need to necessarily send out actual flights to see whether they'd work, or is that something that's not a possibility?
Well, at the end of this segment, that's one of my suggestions. You're getting ahead of me.
I'm getting ahead of you.
But no, that's right. I think they could send out remotely piloted vehicles, RPVs, and of a special design, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Now, the other thing that's a big unknown with this volcano is how long is it going to erupt? Now, the volcano is still erupting today, but it is not spewing ash up into the high atmosphere. Its eruption has subsided considerably, but it could start up again, and there's a second large volcano near the small one, and I'll leave it to you to pronounce the name of the volcano for us.
I actually met a woman from Iceland last week and had her tell me the name of the volcano that had erupted, and I just couldn't get it. I tried. It was like water coming out of her mouth. You know, just this beautiful rolling sound, and yeah, no, couldn't do it.
I've looked at the spelling and it's hopeless. And Leo was playing the correct pronunciation by an Icelandic person the other day, and you're ahead of the game to not look at the spelling and just say Ilya forgot the yogurt. And that's a lot closer than trying to pronounce it from the spelling.
Ilya forgot the yogurt. Nice.
Yeah. Nice. That isn't it, but it's a lot closer than trying to pronounce it the way it's spelled.
Oh. Ilya fayak yoku.
Yeah, now you're getting close.
I could almost be a native.
The other thing that I got a bang out of is Leo on our special was playing back various Icelandic people pronouncing it, and it wasn't consistent even with them, let alone the newscasters.
Good. So we know we don't have it that badly. Right.
But anyway, Lufthansa flew these test flights, and then the military, a Finnish plane and another military plane. There's two different countries involved, and they flew military aircraft up into the cloud and did some sampling and so forth. And they came down, and the pilots reported, said, "Hey, the engine didn't surge. It seemed to run fine. Everything was lovely. Maybe we're overreacting." And the aircraft mechanics looked inside the engines with borescopes and various probes and said, "Wrong. These aircraft are grounded. There's glass coatings all through these engines, and you're lucky they didn't fail."
Wow.
So that got everybody's attention. Now, the next thing that's happening and is in the news today is there is great pointing of fingers in Europe, and the airlines are saying, "Hey, we lost $1.8 billion or something like that, an enormous amount of money. By the government grounding all these aircraft, so we want compensation."
Now, who are they going to try and get compensation from? The volcano?
From the government, because like, the government shut them down. Well, of course, if they hadn't shut them down, you know, what if the government had said, "Oh, hey, let's just let the free market take care of this. You know, if the airlines want to fly, they can decide whether or not to fly." And of course, if an airplane had gone down.
Right. And then all of the lawsuits, the people they would have to compensate in return for the deaths, the loss of the planes. Like it probably wouldn't have just been one plane. It could have been several planes. Yeah. They should count themselves lucky. Sorry that they have to deal with this, but it's called Earth, the planet. Sorry.
Well, I think Mother Earth was just simply sending a message to the human race: you are not completely in control. You know, you every now and then we have to have a little humbling experience that shows us. And what? Not only were we not in control, we were not well prepared for this. And that's the next topic. The key thing in this whole incident. There are several key things. Number one, we lacked hard. Remember, I did a show on Show Me the Data.
Yep.
Well, they lacked any kind of hard scientific data. This cloud, the only way you can really know what's going on up there is to fly some kind of test flights through the cloud and sample what is the constituency of the plume, how dense is it, what effect will it have on engines, et cetera. So yeah. You need hard data to make those decisions. So here are my suggestions. My suggestion is, number one, just as you anticipated, very wisely, I might add, that they should fly drone aircraft, non-piloted aircraft. But now the next thing I think is possible. Now, I believe this is only possible with a small drone aircraft. So I hope somebody doesn't say, hey, let's put I'm going to suggest, let's put it on big jets and, you know, they can fly anytime. There are devices called centrifugal dust filters. I don't know whether you've seen the TV ads, but they make a vacuum cleaner that works on this principle. It has no filter, and yet by spinning the material it vacuums up from the floor, it can separate the particles in the air from the air. So divert them into a bag or a collection area. So I think they could build an engine that would divert the particles out of, you know, a vent out the bottom of the plane, and provide clean air to a reciprocating or small turbine engine in a drone.
Maybe you should get on this idea and patent it now before anybody else jumps on it.
Right. Exactly. I think that centrifugal filter is well patented on vacuum cleaners.
Right. So. But maybe this new, new applications. Yeah. So you can apply it to circumventing the silica particles getting into the engines. Yes.
The other area of research that I think they should look into is, of course, I worked in the area of remote sensing and satellite ground stations. So the question I would have, is it possible to put some kind of narrowband filters or some combination of filters on a satellite that looks down at these clouds and can distinguish the difference between an ash cloud and what it's made of and the water vapor clouds? Now, again, that would be limited to only seeing the tops of the clouds, and you probably couldn't look into the cloud. Right. And measure density. But I believe there's an area of research there that we might equip satellites with a special additional filter or whatever that might give us more hard data about the position, location, and nature of these plumes, and would give us better understanding of where the plumes are, where they're located, etc.
And then additionally, how the air currents are moving particles, particulate matter, through the atmosphere and where they might end up in eddies in the atmosphere, where they might end up building up or being more dispersed.
Now, they do have very good digital winds models right now. And I worked with those when I was writing software for the airline dispatch business. And so if they can know the initial position of these clouds and so forth, they can do a reasonable job of forecasting where they're going to go. However, they need that initial data and know the difference. Right now, they can't tell the difference between the water vapor cloud and the ash cloud. So they need that. Right. Now, my final recommendation is I think Europe and North America, because this could happen over here too. Remember Mount St. Helens?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we should have central scientific bodies, experts in this area, that could do research in this area and come up with suggestions for how to equip a drone, how to make a drone that could fly through these clouds, and how to gather hard data, not speculation, not guesswork, but gather hard data about these events. They're very rare, but look, this one they say costs $1.8 billion. Don't you think we could spend $1 million or two, knowing how to deal with it in the future?
Yeah. I was also thinking another along the idea of getting hard data and research, you could maybe take a look. I remember looking at how the stopping the airlines after 9/11 affected water vapor and particulate matter and carbon dioxide emissions, greenhouse gas emissions during that period of time. So this was a significant lessening of airline traffic. So maybe there would be a similar comparison that could be done to see what kind of a pre-Earth Day impact we had on the atmosphere by stopping that.
Right, exactly. But I think we should, government, should fund a scientific body to gather data. Now, let me say, that scientific body should gather data and do research and then disseminate the data to the controlling agencies, to the, to the air traffic control, to the Met folks, meteorological weather people, and to the airlines themselves, and then let those bodies make the decisions. But they can't make intelligent decisions without a way to gather the data.
Yep.
So that's what was missing, in my opinion, and that's what caused all the chaos, because a lot of this was just speculation. And we didn't have enough hard data. They had some, and they knew this was a danger. But the call to ground all the aircraft, which I think was wise. If I'd have had to make that decision, that's what I would have done, to play, err on the safe side. But it could have been made with a lot more information. That's all I'm suggesting. Exactly.
I'll agree with you there. I will agree.
Well, now the next story that came in from one of our readers, which I found interesting. The Navy flew a Green Hornet. I love the title of this test flight.
It makes me think of the Green Lantern every time. Yeah. The Green Hornet.
Yes. Well, of course, an F-18 is named a Hornet, or the latest ones are Super Hornets. And they did a test flight very recently. I think was it today? They're doing the test flight at any rate.
We got to know.
Yeah, one of our fellows. And they're using a mix of JP-5, which is normal jet fuel for a fighter aircraft, and a 50-50 mix of that and a biofuel. And so this is an attempt to try out biofuels in jet aircraft. Now, I have to say that turbine engines are very tolerant of a wide range of types of fuels as compared to piston aircraft or piston engines of any kind. So I think this is very likely to work because, like I say, turbine aircraft, some of the turbines that I've read the specs on will burn anything from 100-octane gasoline, JP1, JP2. In other words, they will work just fine. They're certified to run on all these different fuels. So they have a wide tolerance. So I think, this is very likely to be a success. And I hope that's the case,
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's trying to use as many different fuel types as possible and not relying on just one. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, as the adage goes. But it just seems like it's a really great idea to be investigating and seeing how the engines will tolerate biofuels, how they will tolerate this different standard of fuel, where these things come from. I've been trying to look for, there's a video on the website, there's where the story came from. There's a place where there's a link that says you can watch it here. And I was trying to load that up to see if we could actually watch it, but it's not loading very quickly. So unfortunately, we don't get to see any footage of that. But it's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah.
You think?
And of course, the 50% bio side of it is all from renewable sources, not non-renewable hydrocarbon fuel. So we could reduce our dependence on oil, and that would be a plus in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, and 50% is pretty big. I mean, this isn't 5%. I mean, that's half.
No.
Half.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a significant reduction.
Exactly. And the reason they can do that, again, is because turbine engines are so tolerant of, can burn a very wide range of fuels that have different volatilities. So, you know, it's exciting. I hope they, now let me point out that burning biofuel, unfortunately, it does take us away from dependence on oil and non-renewable resources. But my understanding of some of the research I've read is that it doesn't reduce the emissions in the atmosphere that we would like to get rid of. So we'd still like to have a fusion-powered airplane. That's always been my...
Yeah, that would be really nice. But even though it doesn't get rid of the emissions that we're talking, the source of them is different. So basically what's happening is we're taking from stuff that's within the carbon cycle and has not yet been shoved into storage inside the earth. So that's the problem with the fossil fuels, is that we're taking things that have been put away and stored in the back of the closet that you just completely forgot about, you know, that, and it's just better to keep them there. And when you start taking them out, it just opens up all sorts of trouble. So you get rid of the fossil fuels, and we're staying within that that cycle, and it's much healthier.
Right. All of those fuels ultimately are solar energy stored.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and that's why I fly gliders, because they use solar power directly.
Are you going glider flight? Have you gone glider flying?
Yes.
In the name of Earth Day?
Well, I go glider flying almost every weekend in the name of fun.
But, yeah.
But I do. You know, it makes me feel better to know that I'm only using a small amount of fuel to get launched by the tow plane, and then I can spend all day up in the air in a glider. And
awesome.
And again, I'm using solar power that causes thermals and causes the winds and the wave flying and the various kinds of lift that I use while I'm flying a glider and staying up all day. Ultimately, all of that energy comes from the sun, and it's only very indirectly used by me. I mean, there's only been one conversion from solar energy to mechanical wind energy or thermal energy that I use. So that, I have to say, that does warm the cockles of my heart.
with the sun.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, I mean, I've done all kinds of flying. I've flown float planes. I've flown hot air balloons. I've flown multi-engine, all kinds of airplanes. I've flown over 50 different types of aircraft. And I've logged about 2,800 hours in these various aircraft. And people ask me, you know, well, okay, you've tried it all. And I've even got an hour or two in a helicopter. And I said, if someone came to me and said, Ray, you can only fly one type of airplane, it would be sailplanes. It would be gliders. I truly love it because you are working with nature. You're not just using brute strength and awkwardness. You're using your intelligence. You're using your knowledge of the air currents. And you're communing with nature. And in my case, I fly in a beautiful mountainous area that has some of the most beautiful scenery on Earth. So it's a great escape and a great relaxing event for me.
Moving on from the Green Hornet, which I have been told by the chat room, informed, yes, the Green Hornet was a character. I think Bruce Lee was the Green Hornet at one point.
So, right. Yeah.
Not just the Green Lantern, but also the Green Hornet.
That's what I thought. I thought there was a comic book character that was
both.
The Green Hornet.
There are both. You also have something on here about an aero car.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of a little diversion, but ever since I was a small child, popular mechanics and popular science have always had these pictures of these vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that were coming any day now. And they usually called them aero cars. And they were going to take off out of your driveway, and you were going to be able to fly anywhere you wanted very quickly. And I wanted to comment on that, because every now and then somebody brings them up, and there's always somebody working on one. There's been somebody working on an aero car for the past 50 years. And to various kinds of levels of success. But I really don't think we're going to see one anytime soon. And furthermore, if we did, it would be my personal worst nightmare.
Why is that?
I'm going to be really selfish.
Okay.
I just described going up in the sky and soaring in a sailplane in the mountains. And most of the time that I'm up there in the area that I fly in, I only see a handful of other sailplanes that have my friends who are flying out of the same field with me. And I see the odd transient aircraft coming through the area. And we're talking to them on the radio so that we can stay clear of each other. And I really enjoy that. Now, imagine I look down from my glider and I can see Highway 1 that crosses Canada. It goes right by our field. And I look at all the thousands and thousands of cars that go by me. And the thought of all of those being able to lift off and, dare I say it, clutter the sky with that many airplanes or aircraft would frighten the daylights out of me. I mean, I just can't imagine that kind of density of aircraft in the sky. Now, if they were going to do this, they would have to have some kind of automated control and keep these, you know, keep these on a very low and very tight highway in the sky, if you please. If they didn't, it would be utter chaos. It would just be impossible. And to put that many vehicles in the sky would require that, you know, you have a fully automated. Yeah, there's a picture of one that you found. You know, yes. A current one that's being worked on. Now, there's another problem with these aircraft. These aircraft don't glide.
No, okay? Not at all. They need their turbine engine power. They're not going to glide. They're not nice and easy in the skies. These things need energy. They need fuel to do what they need to do. They're fighting gravity every moment.
And if they were 200 feet in the air and had an engine failure, you're dead. Because now let me point out something a lot of people don't understand. Helicopters can glide. You can turn the engine off on a helicopter, and as long as it's in what's called the safe operating envelope of the helicopter, which means it either has altitude or forward speed, it can have, you know, the engine can fail and it can glide to Earth and land safely. And a lot of people don't know that. So helicopters can glide. These aircraft with these very, very short ducted fans do not glide at all. And if they lose power, they fall out of the sky. So that's another major problem. Now, there's people who have said, well, we'll install rockets that take over, you know, for the engines in an emergency, and the rockets run long enough, a throttled rocket that, you know, you could land quickly and save your bacon. But so far, nobody's, you know, built one of these that's successful. The other thing is all VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that could land in your driveway are inefficient. The helicopter is the highest cost per seat mile of any aircraft in the sky. And by the way, helicopters are reasonably efficient compared to ducted fan aircraft. So a ducted fan aircraft is a horribly inefficient, and as we're having energy problems and looking around for new sources of energy, this is not the right aircraft to look at. You know. So, any rate, that's just an aside, my thoughts on the aero car.
Or the sky car, or what have you.
It's been around ever since I was knee-high to a duck, and I, as a kid, I used to read those and think, oh, next week Dad's going to get one of these and we'll have it, you know, and of course it didn't happen.
I'm still waiting for the hover skateboard. That's what I'm waiting for. I don't need to be that high off the ground, but just a skateboard, anti-gravity skateboard, pretty hot.
Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Well, now we get to the, at least I think, this is the hangar flying portion of Maxwell's House. And I'm going to tell some stories. And today I've chosen some stories out of my days at McDonnell Aircraft, where I worked on the F-4 Phantom. I worked in HF communications. And I just want to give you a little history of the F-4 Phantom. This was an aircraft that would originally, I think, was test flown in 1958. It flew throughout the 60s, It has an incredible history. It had a gross weight of about 60,000 pounds. So this fighter bomber weighed considerably more than any World War II bomber. It carried a load of up to 18,500 pounds of weapons, bombs or what have you, missiles. And and by the way, that's considerably more than any World War II bomber could ever even think about carrying. A very unique thing about this aircraft was it was flown first by the U.S. Navy and then the U.S. Marines and finally the U.S. Air Force. And as far as I know, there were no other aircraft that there were configurations that were flown by both the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force. The aircraft were different. Their landing gears were different. The ones that landed on carriers had a reinforced heavy landing gear with a very wide tire. The Air Force model had a narrower tire, but basically they were the same airframe. Now, the other unique thing that claimed to fame by this aircraft is, again, as far as I know, it's the only aircraft that was flown by both the Navy Blue Angels precision flying team and the Air Force Thunderbirds precision flying team. And I actually, when I was at McDonnell Aircraft, I actually worked on the team that retrofitted VHF communications radios into the Blue Angel aircraft that were brought to St. Louis so that they could fly into civilian fields. So I actually got to touch a Blue Angels airplane. And wow. It was thrilling for a young man of 23 years old, and I was quite excited. The other thing is this aircraft was flown by 11 other nations. One of the ironies is I remember one of my fellow engineers was out at an Air Force base supporting some test program, and he said while he was there in the same lunchroom, there were pilots from Israel and pilots from Iran, both being trained to fly the F-4 Phantom, because we sold them to both of those countries at the time. Of course, this is when the Shah of Iran was in control of Iran and so forth. So at any rate, that's something about the aircraft. So now I want to tell you about my experience with a test flight that I monitored. My job at this particular time was to go over and brief the pilots on the equipment that I was testing, which was the HF communications equipment. And then I was to go to the Flight Line Observation Post. That the acronym for that, of course, is FLOP, F-L-O-P.
I like it.
And that's where I flopped during the test flight. And from this room, this special room, I could monitor all of the telemetry signals from this test aircraft. Now, let me explain. These test aircraft had very special electronics that we had installed in them that would send back by radio channels all kinds of data while the aircraft was in flight. We also had very primitive tape recorders that recorded all this data while the aircraft were in flight as well. But any rate, sitting in the flop, I could see at any instant, I could monitor the altitude, airspeed, engine RPM, exhaust temperature, and then the things I was interested in, I could monitor the operating temperatures of the HF radio as they used it and monitor the power that it was putting out and many other things. Now, the kind of fun thing that I enjoyed was one of the telemetry channels was connected to the intercom system and radios in the aircraft. So that meant from where I was sitting, I had a little speaker and I could hear every word that the pilot and the RO, the RO is the radar observer, the pilot that's in the back cockpit. I could hear every word that they said to each other and to any radio conversations they had to air traffic control. So in other words, I could hear everything they said. And sometimes these conversations were quite interesting. Now, you have to understand that these guys were treated with great respect. And my boss, when I started to do this job of briefing and debriefing test pilots, took me aside and he said, Ray, I want you to understand something. In the official meetings, test pilots do not make mistakes. Never in the debriefing say, the stupid pilot didn't operate the equipment right. No, he said, you say the fuse blew or I'm sorry about that. My equipment failed or whatever. And then you follow the pilots out of the briefing and you go down the hall and you say, Hey, Rosie, next time you use that HF radio, I want you to hold that button down for 3 seconds or whatever, you know, and they always, oh, thank you very much. I'll make sure I do that next time. No problem. So now let me tell you that on this particular flight, the pilot's name was Jack and the RO, his nickname was Rosie. His last name was Rosemeyer. And I never forget, his crash helmet had the picture of a rose on it. And we all called him Rosie, which was his nickname. And the RO in the back seat was in charge of operating the inertial navigation system, the radar and weapons system, and the HF radio. So, any rate, they're on this test flight, and I'm sitting in the flop, and I'm listening to them, and they're going down their test flight. They have a clipboard with, you know, what they're supposed to do during this test flight. And suddenly I hear Rosie say, Jack. And by the way, they always talked in a voice as much as possible, like all the famous test pilots, Chuck Yeager and so forth. You know, they're always really cool on their transmissions. Says, Jack, I just lost the inertial navigation system. It's non-functional now. Jack, Roger, understood. So a minute or two later, he comes up and says, Jack, I just lost the radar and the weapon system.
Oh, my gosh.
And Jack says, oh, my, okay. So then he says, Jack, I just lost the HF radio. He said, I'm just along for the ride now. He said, you know what, Jack? He says, you know, maybe we ought to go home before something serious happens. There was a pause, and Jack says, Rosie, it's too late. The hydraulics just failed.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, let me explain what this entails. It was quite interesting. There are several hydraulic systems on the aircraft, but the one he was referring to is the one that lowers the landing gear and also operates the brakes. So when this kind of failure happens, there are cylinders of high-pressure air that they release into the hydraulic system, and they do what's known as blow the gear down. So this air goes in, and it blows the landing gear down and locks it. And this is for emergency use only. Now, after they blow the gear down, there's enough air pressure left to apply the brakes twice, only twice. So the standard procedure is they come in for a landing, they get as slow as they dare, they touch down, they pull the drag chute, which comes out of the back of the aircraft, it slows it down, and when they hit a certain speed, they apply and they hold full brakes, which locks the wheels. Now, when you lock the wheels, the tires blow.
Right.
Okay. And then you're riding on the hubs, the, you know, metal hubs of the wheels. And you're on this runway, which, by the way, has been foamed by this time to try and reduce some of the friction. But you're grinding through the metal hubs. Ugh. Now, if you time your application of the brakes right and at the right speed, you won't grind all the way through the hub and start grinding into parts in the landing gear, which cost a lot more and
right.
are a lot more complicated. So you're sliding down the runway, grinding the hubs of the wheels with blown tires. There's smoke flying out from the burning tires and all of this sort of stuff. And you finally come to a halt. And by the way, these guys are super cool and super calm throughout all of this. And then there's a great big giant crane comes running out onto the runway and has to pick this aircraft up and get it off the runway because this was an airport shared by civilian and military aircraft and McDonnell Test Flight and flying schools. This is Lambert Field in St. Louis.
So it's busy.
Oh, it's very busy. I used to instruct there. And so they come out and pick up the plane with this big crane and take it back to the ramp at McDonnell Aircraft. and, you know, and then, you know, go through all the things. But anyway, I'll never forget that famous line when, you know, when Rosie says, "Hey, Jack, I'm just along for the ride." In other words, everything in the back cockpit had failed. And it was something else. Now, let me tell you one more quick story about Rosie, because I think this is very instructive. I got to know Rosie and you know, did many briefings and debriefings when I was an engineer there. And I also got my flight instructor's rating in small aircraft on Lambert Field. And I was instructing private pilots in the evenings and weekends when I wasn't working at McDonnell Aircraft. So one day, I'm there, and the chief flight instructor calls me over, and he says, "Hey, I've got a guy who knows you, and he wants you to check him out in a Mooney Mark 21. It's a high performance single engine airplane, and I look up, and it's Rosie. It's this test pilot, and so." I was kind of almost cowed by this, you know, and I shook his hand and said, "Hi, Rosie, how are you doing?" And I said, "You know, I really feel inadequate to you know, give a check flight to a guy of your experience and, you know, a test pilot." And I will never forget what he said to me, and this really had an impact. He looked at me and he said, "Ray, who knows more about this particular aircraft, you or I?" He said, "I've never flown this aircraft before in my life." He said, "Really top-notch pilots never hesitate to get a thorough checkout in any new airplane, no matter how much experience they've got. And I want you to be hard on me, and I want you to really thoroughly check me out, and don't let me get away with the thing because I'm a test pilot." And that, you know, that really stuck with me. And what that taught me, and I've heard inexperienced pilots come into flying schools and say, "Well, how long will it take me to check out? You know, I've got all this time and I want to, why can't I just take this airplane? You know, look, I've flown all these other types and stuff." The top-notch pilots never say things like that. They always want a thorough checkout in any new kind of aircraft. And that really, really, really stuck with me. And, you know, to this day, and anytime I check out in a new airplane or anything, I want a thorough checkout, and it doesn't matter how many types of aircraft I've flown or how experienced I am or, you know, what I've done. Right. Top-notch pilots want thorough checkouts.
Right. They don't want to just trust in what's handed to them. You want to get it checked out. You want to know that it's going to work when you get up there.
Right. Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I'll throw in one more story from that era. This was the day I got a Marine pilot in trouble. Now this guy, you know, this Marine pilot and his RO came in, and they were going to. Let me explain something. All test flights at McDonnell Aircraft at that time were done by members of the U.S. Navy or Marines. Now this, even the Air Force planes, their acceptance test flights were done by Navy pilots at McDonnell. At McDonnell Aircraft, we had an office full of Navy pilots and Navy personnel, and they were there to do the acceptance test flights on each of the production airplanes. And so these guys came in and were going to do this test flight on this F-4M, which was a British Phantom. And what was special about this aircraft is instead of having the General Electric engines, it had Rolls-Royce Spey engines, which actually had more thrust than the U.S. version of the aircraft. So this thing had a little more oomph than the U.S. version of the airplane. So they went out for their first test flight, these two Marine pilots, and I briefed and debriefed the flight. And I noticed, again, at the flight line observation post that the Marine pilot climbed out very gently, and, you know, he had never flown this particular model of the airplane, and he was getting used to it and whatnot. So at the debriefing, young, brash Ray Maxwell said, "Gee, that was a gentle climb you did. You know, you've got those Rolls-Royce Spey engines. I had kind of expected more from a Marine pilot." Hint, hint. Which was stupid of me to say. But I was young and brash. So...
I can't imagine.
I came back the next day for another test flight. We did the briefing. And I can't remember whether I reminded him of my remarks or whatever. But then I went to the flight line observation post to listen in on the flight. And I heard, you know, I heard him call on the radio and he says, Lambert Tower, this is flight test 2020, requesting an unlimited climb out. Now, that meant a full afterburner, almost straight up takeoff. And so sure enough, they cleared him for the unlimited climb, and he hit full afterburner, and he rotated and pulled this aircraft up in about a 50 or 60 degree climb and, you know, just almost went straight up. So he went on to run his test flight, go through the various things that he was supposed to do. So after the flight, I left the flight line observation post, and I was walking down the hallway, and I was going to the debriefing room. And I ended up being right behind the pilots as they came off the flight line. And right in front of me, about 20 feet ahead of me, this Navy brass that happened to be on the field. Now, I didn't know they were even on the field or what was going on, but some high-ranking Navy guy comes out of one of the side hallways and he says, you know, I forget, this guy was a captain or a major, this test pilot, he says, you know, Major, come here. You know, what was that high-performance takeoff all about? I've looked at your flight plan, and it doesn't call for that. And he dressed this guy. He dressed this guy down royally because it wasn't in the, you know, it wasn't in the plan. And he was, you know, he was having fun trying out this new airplane. And, of course, I kept my head ducked through the whole debriefing. And the Marine pilot only asked me about the HF radio, and he never said, boy, you got me in trouble or anything. He just, you know, it was just suck it up and sorry, sir, it won't happen again. And, you know, and he talked straight business with me, and, you know, there were never any repercussions for me, but it was the day I got the Marine pilot in trouble with a few remarks that I'd made in the previous debriefing.
Nice. Anyway,
that was the fun of working at McDonnell Aircraft back in the 60s, 1966 to 68, and some of the things I got to observe firsthand. And for a young kid, it was pretty exciting times.
Oh, yeah. Seriously exciting times. I mean, so much new stuff going on. That's, and so many Marines to get in trouble.
Right. Oh, shame on me.
So, Ray, what do we have on the docket for next week?
Well, you know, I'm still working on it. Here's the thing. So much of the content of the show is going to be news now, and aviation news is changing so rapidly, it's hard for me to predict. But I promise I'll have some more hangar flying and some more interesting stories for next week.
Great.
I may have 2,800 hours in the air, but I have tens of thousands of hangar flying and good stories.
Well, I'm looking forward to them. I'm definitely looking forward to hearing them. And if people want to email you with possible topics in aviation that you can cover or possible stories or anything, where can they reach you?
They can reach me at ray@twit.tv. And I see someone's asking, has Ray been limited to aviation? They are asking me for the time being to focus on aviation. Like I say, there's lots of things happening at the Twit Cottage. There's new staff and new people coming on. And we're going to try and focus some of our people in more specific areas. And they've asked me initially to focus in the area of aviation. So we'll see how that goes. And that's what we're going to try out. And please give me your feedback. And you can reach me at ray@twit.tv.
And anybody who is interested in subscribing to this program can go to twit.tv/MH, where you can find links to past episodes and subscribe. You can also look for it in the twit.tv or Twit Network in iTunes and subscribe and get all sorts of great back episodes of things that Ray's brought up from science to aviation and beyond. I hope you enjoyed watching the show, listening, and keeping up with the world of aviation. Ray, this is really great. Thank you.
All right. We'll see you next week.
See you next week, everybody. Thank you.